Thanks for joining us at the Business Growth Cafe, where each week we select from a menu of topics for a focused discussion with an industry expert to provide insights that can impact your business's growth. With your host, Angelo Ponzi.
I am Angelo Ponzi, your host here at the Business Growth Cafe, and thank you for joining us. Today at the cafe, I'm excited to welcome back Don Reese, CEO of The Wooden Floor, and Marcelo Rios, CEO of Human Options, to discuss the business of building and running a nonprofit. Welcome.
Thank you.
Now, you were both back here in mid-February, I believe, and looking down at my notes. So we had an incredible conversation. So first of all, if you're tuning in, we want you to go back to the February show, listen to that. This is, if we're going to count that as part one, this will be part two, and we're going to do a part three. So this is going to be very exciting. You're going to get lots of information and learn how to have a successful nonprofit. I'm making that promise. We're going to deliver today, okay?
Yes, we will.
All right. So before we get started, though, let's, for those newcomers, let's put it in perspective and let's give me a little overview of who you are and what your nonprofit is about. And Don, I'll go with you first.
Okay, great. Thank you, Angelo. So The Wooden Floor is a creative youth development organization. Right now we're headquartered in Santa Ana. We have two locations and we serve 475 children year-round from two locations now. Our goal is to use dance education combined with academic tutoring, college and career readiness, and social services in order to support children over a 10-year journey from third grade all the way through high school. And really, at the end, our end goal is to transform more young people in low-income communities through the power of dance and that access to higher education. And we know that it works because this year is our 15th year in a row that 100% of our students have graduated high school and immediately enrolled in higher education. And so now that we're taking this model also nationally, we have our first licensed partner in Washington, D.C., and we're hoping that we'll have future partners in the near future. But today, it's all about growth in Orange County. And since we last met, we've now identified our third location, also in Santa Ana.
Fantastic.
And hoping that we'd be able to bring on more children, at least 100 more children by 2021. So about myself is I started in the for-profit sector in management consulting in the high technology sector, working with software companies in helping them develop strategy, HR services, finance services, and business development. And I was very fortunate that my first boss and mentor really encouraged me to give back into the community. So I also worked in some boards when I was only in my 20s in arts, education, and human services boards. And so fast forward, today I'm at the Wooden Floor and I'm in arts, education, and human services. And our goal today is really to move young people forward.
Fantastic.
And I was just going to add that I'm also now also on the board of 1OC. I'm also the chair of the Nonprofit Advisory Council. And I'm also on the board of Orange County Music and Dance, and then I've just joined the Santa Ana Chamber as well.
And you sleep when? Wow. I thought I was busy.
Yeah, but it's all in part of, you know, kind of tying to some questions we're going to talk about later about how we really build the brand of the Wooden Floor in the community, and the number one way we do it is through our own leadership footprint.
Okay, fantastic. Marcella?
Sure. Human Options ignites social change by educating Orange County to recognize relationship violence as something that threatens everybody. We advocate for those that are affected by abuse and extend a safe place for victims while empowering survivors on their path of healing. And so we actually run a sort of full comprehensive array of services. We prevent violence and relationship violence through education in the schools by making sure that there is someone as a first responder to recognize relationship violence early on and to intervene and get that person on a path to healing. We also do much more protection, which is more in our residential settings where we are doing emergency shelter, transitional housing, and really invested in ending homelessness for victims of domestic violence. We also empower, and a lot of that is done through educational components, making sure that women and children and men that are being affected by relationship violence know their rights, know the access of how they can access the legal system to get protections that they might need, how to access different types of services and then really empower them to go out and live their full potential in the community. We have been in Orange County for over 38 years, which is extremely exciting, and are currently launching and hoping to impact networks in addition to communities. And that is done through partnerships. We've been educating healthcare practitioners over the years to recognize relationship violence. We've been educating beauticians as well, and beauticians have been extremely helpful.
So really reaching out into the community itself and helping raise awareness for people to pay attention to what's going on.
Absolutely. And it's really something where we've noted that somebody has told their story multiple times and never really gotten the response or the assistance that they've needed. And what that does is that essentially feeds into somebody's, what they've been hearing from their abuser for years, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody's going to care. Nobody's ever going to help you. And so what we do is try and break that by making sure that when somebody's sharing their story, that they know that they're being listened to, that it's not okay, and they get connected to assistance.
Okay. I think you used the phrase before, prevention and intervention is kind of the two lanes mm-hmm. you take. Mm-hmm. So, but you didn't mention about yourself.
Yes.
So, you're the CEO. Let's talk about that. Let's talk about your rise. The emerging of you guys. We talked in the hallway.
Sure. For the last 3 years, I've been the CEO at Human Options. And prior to that, I was the COO at Human Options. And I'd been there for 10 years. And I worked alongside our founding executive director for that time and really helped get us on a path to expanding our footprint in Orange County. On that journey, I was on the board of directors for the California Partnership to End Domestic Violence and eventually became their board president, where I really got a big feel for what was happening on the statewide landscape and the national landscape in our field. I am currently on the Family Violence Appellate Project Board of Directors, as well as the Continuum of Care Governing Board. And then I sit on a task force at 1OC, which is on board diversity.
Yeah, we both do.
And so you're also very busy.
Make time for you.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that. It's, I had to say it was Friday afternoon and there were drinks. I just didn't tell you it was water and coffee.
I know, darn it.
So I'm going to start off with you, Maricela. Mm-hmm. And you guys have very successful and some longevity. You said 38 years. Don, you said
36
years. I mean, that's longer than a lot of businesses manage to survive. And you guys have been part of that and growing that and really brought a lot of sophistication to it. We're going to talk about a lot of that. But let's take it up 30,000 feet and think about nonprofits in general. And we can pick on Orange County, but in general, what are the biggest challenges that most nonprofits face as they're really trying to grow and, frankly, survive?
Yeah, when I was thinking about that question, I was thinking there's two things. One is, as a nonprofit sector, our work is really intended to change the community and to change the landscape in Orange County, and you don't do that alone. And so as a nonprofit, you're expected to, and you should, work with other nonprofits. And so we've actually kind of coined it as cooperation, right? So it's really hard to both cooperate with another nonprofit and still be like, well, I am brag about yourself at the same time. There's some tension between bragging about yourself as we're a great brand, we've got a solid program, we've got solid outcomes, and still feeling like you can partner with others who are doing like work. And so as I think that is one of the things, is really learning how to uniquely sell yourself, uniquely position yourself, and talk about the great work that you do in service of others while being cooperative and knowing that we share space and there's intersectionality between a lot of our work, and that really you can't negate the work of another organization in order to lift yourself up. So that's one thing that came to mind for me as something that keeps people from growing and thriving, because you're not pushing your brand out enough if you feel like, well, I can't really brag about myself because that's not really what nonprofits do. So I think you have to get comfortable with bragging about the good work because you're doing it in service of someone. And the other thing that came up to mind for me is that in the nonprofit sector is we are reacting to things. We're responding to needs. And so that really sometimes takes away from the idea of really innovating and creating space to innovate. And innovate could be, you're maybe, I think, in some ways, caught up by certain funding streams. We can only do this, or they expect us to do it this way. And there has to be really room to think about bigger ideas mm-hmm. and think about, how would we do this differently? How do we adapt to the changing times? How do we listen to the people that we're serving? Because everything is changing around us, and we can't do things the same way that we have in the past. And without really spending time reflecting and creating that culture of learning within the organization. So knowing that people coming in may see it a different way and actually asking and expecting, tell me how else we could be doing this, right? And then accepting that feedback and integrating it. We get stuck in the way that we've always done it, which essentially then you're not growing if you're not learning from others.
Right. We talk a lot of times about working on your business versus in your business, mm-hmm. and I think that's very reflective of what you said. If we get so wrapped up in that day-to-day and the nuances and chasing, you know, those crises and activities that keep popping up, we don't spend time to really work on it. I did some survey work here in Orange County with some CEOs, and one of the questions we ask is, you know, how much time do you spend working on your business every month? And it really broke down to about an average of 1 hour a day. For me, I don't know, that doesn't seem like a whole lot of time to really be effective, especially when the other statistic that I quote is 90% of executives say that it's not the planning, it's the implementation that their strategic plans fail.
Right.
So really, it's what you said is really important, that these nonprofits spend the time and not get caught up in the nuances every day, but really to step back and look. I somebody told me one time, is, you know, we talked about, you know, getting outside the box. Mm-hmm. He says, you need to get outside the box, walk around the box, and, you know, take it, you know, get the heck away.
I had a friend that said one time, I wish I was in the box. Like, she's always outside the box.
I just close the lid for a little while so I can hang out in the box.
Well, I wish I could. You know, in the nonprofit sector, I think that's what it is. We're always, you know, driving if you're a driver,
sure.
You know.
Sure. Well, let's talk about 30,000 feet for you.
I think listening, I agree with everything what Maricela said. I think for myself is that I look at nonprofits in different spectrums. Mm-hmm. So I think there's the emerging nonprofit, there's the more established nonprofit, medium size, you know, or small to medium size, and then there's those who have had longer term longevity. And even in longer term longevity doesn't mean they're always thriving and surviving. You know, they could be in those modes too. Mm-hmm. And so I think the main kind of through line through that is that you have to have a strategic long-term vision for your work and what your impact of your work is going to do. And even if you're a small nonprofit and you're just kind of getting your feet on the ground, you still have to have a bold vision for what you want to accomplish with whatever that is for yourself. I was just talking about a good friend that runs a nonprofit that is emerging, but she has a bold vision. She's already on the national level, but her budget's fairly nominal, but she's making it happen. And then there's other that are sometimes larger and lumbering, you know, that they're mm-hmm. not learners and innovators. And so when I kind of look at this, it's like some nonprofits sometimes will kind of act small with a scarcity mindset. And no matter where you are in that spectrum, you have to have a big, bold vision for what you want to accomplish, because I believe that will then set other people around you to be super excited. So if the Wooden Floor was doing what it did 36 years ago, it was fantastic. And now we're doing all these great things today. And if we weren't continually innovating and reviewing and making sure that we're staying relevant to the community need, we would also find that same kind of life cycle that businesses go through.
Sure, sure. If you think about, in talking about the vision and having that vision, where smaller nonprofits really struggle and fail? I mean, is that it? They have an idea, they have a mission, they start it, but they're not real leaders, they're not business people, they just think that you know, build it and they will come, so to speak.
Yeah.
Right, so what's that mentality that gets somebody going and then just never really takes off because they just don't have those skills?
You know, it's interesting because I agree with what you're saying, Don, in terms of the vision, and I think that if you really pause and think about vision, that's generally if you focus too much on mission and tactics, and you lose sight of vision, right? Mm-hmm. And so, but if you're really holding that vision, it moves a little bit quicker. What I think mm-hmm. happens in smaller nonprofits and medium-sized nonprofits yeah. quite often as well is that when you get so tied down to like what's happening right in front of you in that moment and the day-to-day challenges and in smaller nonprofits, you've got one person doing four people's jobs, right? And so when you're doing that, I mean, you know, we joked about like whether Dawn sleeps or not, and I'm sure she does maybe 5 minutes a night. But I think, but when you're so focused on the day-to-day minutiae, it's really hard to remember what you set out to do, right? Mm-hmm. I heard a analogy one time. It's like when you're knee deep in alligators, it's hard to remember that your objective was to drain the swamp, right? I think that's kind of it. Is that when you're smaller, you take on so much, you do things all the time, and so. But vision, if you hold vision and you're really looking at that, then you're making strategic decisions about how you invest your time and energy. And that's one of the things that even at our size is we struggle, right? Periodically, we're not making strategic decisions about the investment in time and energy and resources. But we're getting better at it. We're practicing. Yes. How do we make decisions about whether this is something that actually will help advance our mission and our vision? And then really talking about how we're making those decisions so that when people come and bring something, they bring it with that in mind. They bring it knowing that the way they're going to make a decision is through a decision screen that directly reflects our values and the strategic objectives. But that means everybody has to know that. And when you're smaller, it's a little bit more difficult to say that, to do that.
Sure. I'm going to flip this a little bit in kind of a customer first strategy. I talk a lot about this when I'm giving presentations, and so many times I talk to organizations and they think about the products and services that they sell, and I'm great and we're wonderful and you're going to be lucky if you buy our stuff. But they don't really take the consumer, if you will, or the customer in mind when they're developing those strategies and those messaging points. When you guys are talking to in doing making those decisions you were just talking about, I mean, do you have your target, your customer, it's not the right word, but you know, your recipient in mind when you make these strategic decisions, or is it really backing off and thinking about the organization versus if I make this decision, this is going to how it impact?
Yeah, for us, for Human Options, we most definitely do. What we do is we, at the end of every service delivery, so if they are in our residential program or another service, we survey them and try and get a sense of, was this effective? Did this work? So we do it in that manner. And then the other is actually really asking them what they need. So we actually have groups where we sit down and ask, like, what is it we need? Are we meeting the needs? And really design our interventions based on that. It's so critical because we can have all the support in the world, but if you don't have people accessing your services, you're not very successful, right? So there's two different audiences that we're looking at. One is those that we're in service of, and then those who are supporting the service that we're giving. So we can have a ton of support on one end or the other end, but we really have to marry both of them to be successful as an organization.
Okay. How about you, Doc?
One of our guiding principles is we're student-centered in all of our decision-making. And so that's our number one, right at the top. Board, staff, families, all are on board on making sure that all of our decisions are student-centered. So if we got someone come in and pitched us an idea on an adult program to implement, we're like, I'm sorry, we do provide those services through the intervention through the child, but we don't just do these tangentials. And so one of the things we're really known for is being very focused, and because we also have a decision made filter as well, that I think I agree with what Marcella said. When you're smaller, it's difficult because you just have all these things kind of coming at you all the time. But when you get to be at a place where you can establish it, we actually start at mission first. Then we look at partnership relationships or what are the impact to the organization. Then we look at financial implications. We also factor in staffing and timing, making sure we're not, you know, tsunamiing our staff. And then really we take it down to a yes, no, maybe. And the yeses are the ones we pursue. The nos are definitive. We know why we're not pursuing it too early, not fully grown. And then the maybes are ones that look interesting that we'll take to the board, and I'll say, hey, this looks like a new opportunity to maybe scale somewhere nationally in another location. But we're very focused on knowing what we do and why we do it. And so people now know they have to come to us 18 to 24 months in advance in order to pitch a new project to us, because we already have our plans in place and our strategies and what we're trying to accomplish.
Sure. So listening to all this, of course, I feel very fortunate, and the audience won't know this, and Maricela might not even know this, but I actually have a pilot program with you coming up in a month.
Mm-hmm. I think we went through our filter.
And we did. It started about 6 or 7 or 8 months ago. So, but we're really excited about that.
Right.
And certainly it is student focused, and I won't sidetrack us with that conversation.
But just maybe add to it is that we took that that opportunity through the filter. Then we now really do a lot of piloting and before mm-hmm. as part of innovation, as the innovation cycle for us. And so what we're doing with this opportunity is making sure that it works for a majority of a student, taking mm-hmm. a subset of them. And if it does, we're going to scale it up, right. you know, and then we can go to our funders and our supporters and say, look, this is what we're trying to accomplish for the students.
Okay. Yeah. So we're midway, I think, but two suggestions, if you could give to the listeners about how they can help improve running their business of a nonprofit, and I'll go back to you.
I would say that you have to focus on yourself as a nonprofit leader. I would say that's the number one thing. I know that sounds probably contrary to what you'd expect me to say, but if you're not fulfilling your gas tank about it, the nonprofit sector is very challenging, like all business, but because we also have an emotional connection to our families, mm-hmm. We put a lot of output in order to make sure more people know about what we're doing in the community. You have to invest in yourself through leadership development, reading, really focusing on making sure that you're always thinking ahead of where the ball's going, so you can make sure that you can make sure there's no landmines or anything sure. that you're about to hit. And like Marcella said too earlier, is that it can be very easy to get stuck in the weeds. And as a leader of a nonprofit, the number one thing you can do is just invest in yourself as a learner and a listener, and just continue to probe and ask the right questions. From the business context of a nonprofit, is that really you have to get your house in order financially. I was a CFO before a CEO. And so I see both sides of the equation. I unfortunately had to take a nonprofit into bankruptcy a few years ago, and that's not a pretty opportunity. I was the last person kept on from the board. And what it really taught me was that you have to put in really strong, we call them pillars of financial strength, mm-hmm. and it's around your annual fund, your budgeting, mm-hmm. your planned giving, and your endowment. And if you look at your diversification of revenue, even from day one, of saying, just like we do with kids or ourselves, make sure you're saving for tomorrow, starting your rainy day fund, starting a reserve, operating reserve. Today, Weingart Foundation is a foundation up in LA, and even after this post-recession, they've been encouraging and even giving grant dollars to help nonprofits form reserves. And most nonprofits today don't have reserves over 2 to 3 months. But if you start with that as your very beginning of your nonprofit, all the way to the larger nonprofits, make sure, because you want to be there for your clients. You want to be there for who you're serving, because they are in so much dire situation that if you start to stumble, they'll really feel it more than you. And so you have to have that mindset around financial sustainability.
Well, that's great advice. I mean, so many times I did a show talking to a CFO, and my premise was that most small businesses, and I'll include nonprofits, don't really understand their financials and how to read them and really how to plan and budget and do that allocation. And I think that's great, you know, like we deal with our families, right? You want to save 6 months or whatever it happens to be, because if something were to happen, you want to have those reserves. How about you?
Yeah, I mean, what I'd add to that is you have to know the cost of business, right? You have to know the cost of running your nonprofit in order to know how much revenue is going to be generated to fulfill your mission. So, I mean, I think that's really important. The other things that come to mind, and we talked about this a little bit before we went on air, is culture and really thinking about the culture within the organization, because mm-hmm. ultimately culture eats strategy for breakfast, right? So if you don't have a good culture and a strong culture that's helping drive your strategy, then that culture is derailing your strategy, and that takes a lot more time to fix. So you really have to focus on the type of culture and values that you want to have as an organization and spend time doing that. And then the other thing Don and I had an opportunity to talk about recently was really thinking about, you have to have that big vision, that big bold vision that we mentioned earlier, and then operate small. So you can't really be like, oh, I'm this big organization. You still have to act like a small business mm-hmm. and really mind the what you have in terms of resources and all of those different things before you get too big. You can't scale too fast. So you have to really think about, you know, we have this big audacious goal and this vision that we're going to change the world, but you can't do it. But you don't have to do it in this large scale all at once.
Yeah, and it can be over time. I mean, that's a Jim Collins, right? The big, hairy, audacious goal isn't about having something happen in a year or two. It's you know, your ultimate goal that you'd like to achieve.
And I was going to add is Mike Masalem spoke at the grantee reception, and he talked about that even as big as, Edwards Life Sciences worldwide now, 12,000 people, I have lots of friends that work there, is that Mike said is that they still act small. And you have to be humble, you have to act small, because it's just really important that you just don't, as my one donor that I love says, you can't get too big for your britches.
That's funny.
And I have his note on my bulletin board. And it's true, that you just have to make sure you stay humble.
Yeah, absolutely. I think I got time for one more question before the part two of this or this episode ends. We talked last time about active boards and the importance of boards, but through some observations that I've recently have, I can see some of these smaller nonprofits and all the things we've been discussing, but their boards are volunteers, and in my experience, that some of them showed, some of them didn't show, some of them didn't do what they were supposed to do. So, what's some advice you can give about managing volunteer boards, or maybe they need to get away from volunteer boards and get some active and solid boards.
Yeah. But in my experience, I've had a pretty positive experience because I entered into it thinking it's a partnership. I'm not managing them, but I'm actually partnering with them for the benefit of the organization. And that's been really clear from the very beginning as we both approach it as learners. But my board president, myself, and my chairs, the chairs of my various committees and myself spend time really developing a relationship because it's all about relationships and really understanding where do we want to go with the organization and what is it going to take from each one of us to do that. Because that's what it requires. We both have to be equally invested in the success of the organization.
Okay. Dawn?
I'd say the same. Also, I think, your board members are there for passion and purpose, right? They're there for a reason most of the time. And so one of the things that you need to do is hone in on that individual. You can't look at the board as a group. You have to still look at them as that individual board member supporter in order to help you connect with where their heart is. For our model as an example, we're arts, education, health and human services, higher ed. And so our board members they have to obviously love and adopt the whole mission, but they can find the places that they have a passion and purpose. So maybe it's about scholarship support or it's around education, higher ed. Great. Then bring all your friends to our next event we have coming up. But someone else might love our art, our concert, and then bring all their friends to that. So you know what I mean? It's like we really try to hone into that individual supporter. But at the end of the day, I always give, because I have a lot of people come to me who know my story about being in the for-profit sector before the nonprofit sector. And they ask, I'm looking to make this transition, and my number one thing says, are you a consensus builder? The number one thing you need at a board level is consensus and someone that you can help share. Even though I'm the CEO of the Wooden Floor, I have a board of directors I report into for a lot of the major decisions. I still will go to them. Luckily, we have such a great partnership. We partner together. But you have to be a consensus and be okay with that I'm okay that decision may be isn't the right one for the organization. I'm hoping we're on it together, but I have to make sure that that I respect that and their role as a board member. But then we also have expectations of them.
Sure. Okay. Absolutely. Well, we are out of time for this episode. So, Dawn, why don't you tell the listeners how they can contact you and reach you?
Dawn Reese at LinkedIn, Dawn S. Reese, Twitter, Dawn S. Reese, and our website is thewoodenfloor.org.
Okay. Marcella?
mrios at humanoptions.org. Our website is humanoptions.org, and I'm on LinkedIn as well.
All right. Well, thank you so much. Thank you for joining us at the cafe. You can find out more about me and read my blogs and view my show videos at theponzigroup.com or connect with me on LinkedIn as well. And you can subscribe to the show at thebusinessgrowthcafe.com. We're now on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, Spotify, Stitcher, SoundCloud, Spreaker, and others around the world. Join me next episode with these ladies at the Business Growth Cafe.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's discussion at the Business Growth Cafe with your host, Angelo Ponzi. Take a moment to subscribe to this podcast and visit our website at www.businessgrowthcafe.com. Read Angelo Ponzi's blogs at www.theponzigroup.com.